This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, January 11th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. This week, Steve Bannon was forced to resign as executive chairman of Breitbart News. He'd left his job under pressure as the White House chief strategist in August, but continued to serve as the primary spokesman for the extreme right's war on the Republican political establishment. Here's Bannon on the stump in Alabama for Roy Moore.
The Republican establishment, and with the Democratic establishment, they think America's in decline, right? And they're comfortable managing that decline. It is the working men and women in Ohio, in Wisconsin, in Michigan, in Pennsylvania, and yes, right here in Alabama, that rejected that. Make America great again.
Andrew Morantz joins me to discuss the rise of the alt-right and what Bannon's downfall means for the nationalist economic populism that he has championed. Welcome to the podcast, Andrew.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You have been writing about this faction of conservatism really since it found its way into the mainstream. And I wonder if you can take us briefly through the history of it and how Steve Bannon and Breitbart came to be its loudest voice.
Yeah, well, and they're really kind of intertwined. The rise and fall of Bannon are kind of, you know, it's kind of contemporaneous with the emergence of alt-right as a you know, mainstream force. So Bannon becomes the leader of the Trump campaign in summer of 2016, and then he falls out of favor in summer of 2017. You know, in 2016, the wider world kind of became aware of this thing called the alt-right, but they didn't really know or agree on what it was. And so at the time, people like Steve Bannon were saying, we, Breitbart, are the platform for the alt-right. That's a quote that he gave in an interview. And it seems plausible that what he meant was, we want to be an alternative to the establishment right. We don't like the way the Republicans have been doing things. We don't like the way the Democrats have been doing things. We're alternative. That still to this day is how some people use it. And yet all along, the people in the alt-right were using it to mean white nationalism.
And Bannon has proved very good at exploiting that particular faction as well. But let's just go back even further. Thinking about this morning, I was remembering a piece that Connie Bruck wrote for The New Yorker not so very long ago about Steve Bannon. And he really started out in politics when he was still a documentary filmmaker and was going out and talking to Tea Party rallies as early as 2010. One thing that Steve Bannon is very good, he's a master opportunist. So he does have this antenna, and he had it before Donald Trump did, for this underlying sense of grievance and anxiety that he has been so good at exploiting.
Mm-hmm. Well, Donald Trump also has an antenna. It's more an antenna for media attention.
But yes.
So they kind of dovetailed. Bannon was an insurgent, like Andrew Breitbart, the namesake of the news organization that he came to lead after Breitbart's death in 2012. They both had this, you know, sense of, as you say, grievance. I think it was Andrew Breitbart who admiringly called Bannon the Leni Riefenstahl of their movement. So they were flirting with this Nazi imagery for a long time. But that wasn't their main bag. Their main bag was, as Bannon calls it, economic nationalism, meaning essentially the working class has been screwed over and we're going to save them. Now, what that means when the rubber meets the road, what does it mean in terms of a specific tax policy or a specific, you know, immigration policy? They were never really clear, but they didn't have to be because they were insurgents, right? So they weren't prepared for leadership. They weren't prepared to build a governing coalition. They were just trying to drain the swamp, as it were.
I hesitate to give Michael Wolff more publicity than he's already gotten, but just tell us what happened in the last week or two.
Well, so Bannon was always, you know, leading from behind, to use that phrase. He, as it becomes clear in this Michael Wolff book, to the extent that it can be taken as gospel, and Bannon has said this publicly in other sources, that he essentially saw Trump as a useful figurehead. Trump is good at getting attention. He's good at connecting with people. He's good at, you know, coming up with catchy phrases that can be put on hats. But I, Steve Bannon, am going to be the Rasputin of this movement. And, you know, he was drawn to fanciful historical analogies just such as that one. But Trump doesn't like people competing with him for attention. He didn't like when Bannon got on the cover of Time magazine and when people started calling him President Bannon and when Saturday Night Live started depicting him as sitting at the big desk. I mean, these are the things that Donald Trump pays attention to. So that started to put their relationship on the rocks. And, you know, just in this past couple weeks, it went completely off the rails because Bannon was quoted as saying Donald Trump Jr. had these meetings with the Russians that were treasonous and unpatriotic, and that there's zero chance that he didn't bring the Russian agents to meet with his father. So, you know, Donald Trump just goes ballistic. And so within hours, there was this statement saying Steve Bannon's lost his mind. He's good for nothing. He had nothing to do with me. He had nothing to do with my election, which, you know, obviously is completely implausible and has no basis in reality.
So what does all of this mean for this wing of the Republican Party?
Well, it's not really one wing. There were always these rifts, and the rifts are just widening. So during the presidential campaign, everybody could sort of be satisfied at the level of we all don't like Hillary Clinton and we don't want her to be president, and that you could kind of end the conversation there. Once the election's over, you have to start talking to the people you're in the big tent with. And, you know, these differences become more and more pronounced. And because Trump doesn't really seem to have an ideology at all, as far as I can tell, you know, this immigration thing this week, he says, well, DACA, it's going to be a bill of love. And his base erupts and freaks out and says, our whole number one issue was no compromise on immigration, no DACA, close the borders. That's what you said on the stump. That's what you kept promising us. But Trump doesn't really like sticking to promises because he's not really a consistency kind of guy.
So what happens now? Bannon's no longer the face and voice of Breitbart. He's on the outs. What happens to that movement?
Well, there are ways that people can be effective from the outside. So Ann Coulter, for example, has always been outside the administration. Whenever there were rumors of her going into it, she quashed them. She always said, I can be more useful from the outside. And she has, you know, every day on Twitter, she's railing at Trump to build the wall. There was a possible universe in which Bannon could be a figure like that. The problem is this movement was built on these kind of almost quasi-autocratic, you know, feelings in the base that, you know, you don't cross the leader. And so once Bannon crossed Trump, his credibility started to wane. And it was actually amazing to watch the comment section on Breitbart that day. You know, Bannon has always said, if you want to know what the people think, you go to the comment section on Breitbart, right? So I went to the comment section on Breitbart, and they turned on him so fast.
This was the day he was ousted.
The day that these comments came out, before he was ousted, because I was trying to read the tea leaves and see what was going to happen. And it sort of seemed clear right away. His people were not conflicted about whether they wanted to pick him or Trump. They picked Trump right away.
So one of the things I'm interested in is the immediate effects we will be seeing on the Republican Party. And we saw a little preview of some of this in the special election in Alabama, where Steve Bannon was supporting Roy Moore, strenuously was down there out on the stump. We heard him at the beginning of the program. Moore lost. What does that tell us? We're talking about reading the tea leaves. Everyone's trying to figure out how indicative that is of some of the races we're going to be seeing this year.
Well, so the Alabama race was a perfect moment for Trump, right? Because he got to endorse both candidates and thereby, you know, have a heads I win, tails you lose kind of strategy. Bannon went all in for Moore, and Moore lost in the deepest of deep red states. His base, his donor base, was not pleased with that. The Mercers have been displeased with him for a long, long time. Over Charlottesville, over Moore, it was not just this Wolf book that drove the wedge between them. The Mercers being his biggest.
And specifically, they were upset with the women issue with Moore. I mean, they just thought it was he was going too far, or?
I mean, there were different. Some people didn't care about that. They just thought Moore couldn't win. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people wanted Mo Brooks to win. There were just a lot of fractures. I think the most interesting thing to me that came out of that whole Moore episode was a tweet from Matt Drudge. He tweeted something to the effect of, okay, so it's clear that there are limits. Moore's loss was an indication to Matt Drudge, this beacon within right-wing media, that there are some things the electorate will not swallow, and credible allegations of child molestation appears to be one of them. So we're at this, frankly, crazy moment where we're sounding out the boundaries of what people will accept, and we have to actually empirically test whether child molestation is one of those things or not. Okay, so according to Matt Drudge, there are limits.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Trump also holds the mainstream media in thrall, as we've been seeing in many ways over the past year, but it's been particularly obvious this past week. He is succeeding to a remarkable degree, Trump, in making the entire country captive of his reality TV presidency. Could you talk a little bit about that?
That's been his great talent his entire adult life. He was never very good at real estate. He was good at playing the role of successful real estate magnate in the media. His talent is getting the media to pay attention to him in ways that can be snarky or derisive. They can say he has short fingers, whatever. He doesn't care. They can say he, you know, one of the first big stories about him in the 80s was that he was a racist slumlord who was openly discriminating against his black tenants. It was just pressed to him. He didn't care.
Even though he expresses outrage daily many times on his Twitter.
It's all part of it. You know, he expresses, oh, I hate talking to the failing New York Times, and then he calls up the failing New York Times. You know, I don't doubt that he actually means what he says in some sense in the moment, but it doesn't mean that the next moment he won't feel differently.
So let's go back to how that we saw this at work this week, which was, you mentioned earlier, Trump's televised meeting with members of Congress to discuss immigration. In the course of that meeting, it seems, he expressed two almost utterly opposed points of view about this that has thrown the entire country into a state of absolute confusion yet again. What do you make of that performance?
I just think it's kind of long past time that we stop taking what he said as all that meaningful. You know, there was this whole meme during the campaign of, you know, taking him seriously but not literally. Sure, that's one way of putting it. Another way of putting it is to say what he says today has no bearing on what he'll say tomorrow, or what he says at any time has very little bearing on the truth. So, like, why do we pay so much attention?
I mean, but then how do you cover him? In one respect, the mainstream media has been completely revived by the Trump presidency. On the other hand, we still are being led by the nose.
Yes.
Every day.
Yes. It's a complicated relationship. It's not as if, you know, Trump has smashed the media. As you say, they've gained subscribers. They've gained sort of currency and, in some senses, legitimacy. But what I think you don't have is a shared sense of legitimacy, a shared sense of reality. You know, it's not as if there are just facts out there in the world that are, you know, waiting for people to just uncover them and believe them. And that's every day we get further and further from that and closer to a moment in which our confirmation biases and our, you know, just kind of epistemological bubbles can tell us more about what we believe than the facts themselves.
Do you see, though, a point where the alt-right begins to peter out, that they reach a point of no return? Do you think that we will see in 2018 a kind of a rebuff to this extreme form of conservatism?
Well, 2018 is going to be a lot of different races at the same time, right? And so I think the question is, how much do we read into every race, right? So does the fact that Roy Moore lost in Alabama mean that no, you know, horseback riding reactionary will ever win again? I don't know. I mean, Joe Arpaio is running now in Arizona. Arizona is a much bluer state than Alabama. I would say his chances are slim, but who knows? I mean, I have no idea. So there are limits, as Matt Drudge said, but the limits are always changing. And the alt-right's role, I mean, if you talk about the true alt-right, the white nationalist alt-right, they don't see their goal as we're going to sweep the 2018 midterms and we're going to have, you know, 50 alt-right members of Congress. They see their role as to be the vanguard, the quote-unquote intellectual vanguard, you know, so they want to push things as far to the right as possible.
Are there any particular races we should be watching where there is an alt-right candidate who seems to have, you know, be running a potentially competitive race?
Well, the most interesting one to me is Paul Ryan's seat in Wisconsin. This guy, Paul Neelan, has gone so far. This is a true alt-right And again, you know, we throw the term around loosely sometimes to mean edgy. No, this guy is openly anti-Semitic, openly racist. I mean, I just recently listened to his interview that he gave on a podcast called Fash the Nation, Fash as in fascism. He's the real deal in terms of alt-right. Now, will he win that seat? I do not think so. But that's a vulnerable seat. I mean, Paul Ryan's seat is, you know, we saw what happened to Eric Cantor. He was beaten by someone with effectively no campaign, no experience, no anything. So
that really is the establishment versus
it's
the wing.
It's about as clear-cut as it can get. You know, I don't think we can take anything for granted.
Thanks so much, Andrew.
Thank you.
Andrew Marantz is a contributing writer to the magazine. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review The Political Scene on Apple Podcasts. This podcast was produced by Alex Barron for newyorker.com with help from Hannah Wilentz. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.